Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to bring the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Saturday, October 24th, 2015. Time is 1 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Kawasaki, Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman, and I do expect Representative Munoz shortly. Today we will take up House Bill 3001. That's an appropriation bill that would fund the TransCanada buyout proposal. We'll have a short introduction and quickly move to a presentation on financing issues surrounding the TC buyout proposal. The presenters of the financing issues are only in town for today. So I'd like to have Ms. Pitney, if you can come forward, quickly move through a brief introduction of the bill. She's just going to basically just go through the bill itself and explain that. And then so I'm going to have members, if you can hold your questions for that. Obviously, Pat's here full-time, and the financial advisors are here today. So I want to get through Pat and get them up to the table here so we can hear their presentation. Take a brief at ease. Back to order. We do have multiple members of the legislature and the administration in the finance room at this time. I'm not going to go through and announce them all, so we can get that to the meeting here. Again, we will be wrapping up at 3 o'clock. We'll need to wrap up today, so we'll do our best on that one. Ms. Pitney.
Thank you, Chair Newman. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm the Office of Management and Budget Director for Governor Bill Walker. So the bill is simple and, you know, two pages. Very quickly, I will go through it and then turn the seat over to the gentleman on the financing issues. So Section 1 has three components. The first component is $144,045,000 to capitalize the Alaska Liquid Natural Gas Project Fund. The purpose of this $144 million is to fund the state's equity participation in the Alaska liquefied natural gas portion and to pay for the TransCanada contract in the event that we buy, when we buy them out. So the split on that is about $70 million for the buyout, $68 million in change, and the remainder is for the cash calls for the remainder of the pre-feed stage on the gas pipeline project. The number that you'd heard previously was $108 million. The difference between the $108 million and the $144 million is an increase in the overall feed project cost. It went from $511 million for all partners to $694 million for all four of the partners. That the share of our increase is why it increased from $108 million, which you had heard previously, as late as September, to where we are today. And that cost increase just came out recently with the as they were beginning to review the work plan and budget for November 15. The second part of Section 1 is $13.6 million appropriated from the general fund to the liquefied natural gas project fund to be appropriated to the agencies who are supporting the liquefied natural gas pipeline project. Department of Natural Resources at $2 million. And if you recall, in the budget process last year, our budget request for this component for Department of Natural Resources was $13 million. Only $9 million was funded, so it still is lower than what we had anticipated when we made our request last year. Department of Law is $10.1 million, and this is for the legal contracts. The state is taking a much more active role in driving the project, and that's for helping in drafting and a faster, moving more aggressively on the commercialization aspects and getting the contracts complete. The Department of Revenue is almost 1.4 million, and this is for both personnel and contractual services for the bankability studies. The Section 2 is strictly the ability for AGDC to collect reimbursements and be able to deposit those reimbursements and to use them towards the project. So it's AGDC has done work on behalf of all the partners for the natural gas project, and they can be reimbursed. This is to allow it to go back into the project. Section 3 is that the capitalization into liquefied natural gas fund does not lapse. And Section 4 is a reminder that in the appropriations bill passed at the end of last session, it included a factor recognizing that we would have supplemental appropriations to be able to be used out of the constitutional budget reserve. And so this just kind of reiterates that particular provision that was in the legislation from the previous appropriation bill, so that this fits within that CBR vote from the end of last session. So with that, I will turn it over. Thank you for your time, and welcome back to Juneau.
Thank you, Pat. We'll take a brief at ease while the presenters come up. Back in order. Gentlemen, I'm going to let you introduce yourselves and the companies that you work for if you do that shortly before your presentations.
First, I would like to thank the co-chair and the committee for giving us the opportunity to present today. Our presentation materials, for those who are watching, are available on the legislature's website. For the record, my name is Radoslav Shipkov. I am a director at Greengate. We are an independent financial advisory firm specializing in project finance for energy projects, more specifically oil and gas, LNG, pipelines, and downstream industries such as refineries or petrochemicals, and also more broadly within the energy sector, power plants, transportation sector such as toll roads, et cetera. Within the LNG sector, our experience covers a wide range of large-scale LNG projects around the world. Going back to more than 10 years, we worked on a number of the Qatari LNG deals, Qatargas 2, which at the time was the largest project financing in the world ever done, Qatargas 3, which was the third expansion of the Qatargas project, Ras Gas 2, which is yet another Qatari project but implemented by a different company. More recently, Peru LNG, which is obviously a project in Peru. PNG LNG, this is an LNG project in the country of Papua New Guinea. It consists of, it's a complex project, consists of an upstream development, both associated and non-associated gas, a pipeline, and a multi-train LNG facility. So not very dissimilar from the project we're contemplating here. The Australia Pacific LNG, an Australian project developed by ConocoPhillips and Origin, with an additional complexity unseen in many other LNG projects, which is that the upstream gas supply was provided by a non-conventional gas supply source, what the Australians call coal seam gas, or what here in the U.S. we refer to as coal bed methane. And most recently, we were advising lenders on the Yamal LNG project, which is a Russian Arctic gas development in which we were involved until the U.S. government imposed sanctions on Russia.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Stephen Cantor. I'm a managing director for Southwest Company. We're the financial advisor to the Department of Revenue on the AK LNG project. I have been involved in municipal finance for over 40 years. I've been working in Alaska for over 20. We serve as financial advisor to many of the state agencies, such as AHFC, ASLC. I serve as financial advisor to the Municipality of Anchorage. We serve as financial advisor to the University of Alaska and its system. We serve as many other clients in the state of Alaska. We have an office in Anchorage.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Justin Pelfreyman. I am a director at Lazard, work in the Power, Energy, and Infrastructure Group. Lazard is the largest independent investment bank in the world. We advise governments and corporations on a variety of strategic and financial matters. We are advising the state of Alaska pursuant to SB 138 on the state's financing alternatives with respect to the AK LNG project. And we are working alongside Greengate and First Southwest and the rest of the state finance team.
Okay, go ahead.
So we'll start on slide two. The focus of our presentation today is the financial impact to the state as a result of the termination or the proposed termination of the relationship with.
Could you bring that microphone a little bit closer so everybody can hear clearly?
You can get pretty close. The focus of our presentation today is the financial impact to the state of the termination of the contractual relationship with TransCanada as it currently exists with the state. You will hear separately from Deputy Commissioner Rutherford on the strategic questions about why the state is making this recommendation and why do it now. When we look at the financing issues in isolation, there is an immediate impact on the state, which is the obligation for the state to fund the reimbursement of TransCanada's development costs with interest as required under the precedent agreement with TransCanada, which we will refer to in the rest of the presentation as the PA. And more importantly, going forward, the state will be responsible for picking up the state's share in the midstream components of the project, which under the existing arrangement are funded by TransCanada. So there are three important questions that need to be addressed as part of the context of what the financial implications to the state are. First, what will be the impact on the state's credit rating and borrowing capacity as a result of this action? Second, at what cost can the state be expected to fund its share of the midstream project without TransCanada, and how would this cost compare with what the state will be paying to TransCanada under the existing arrangement? And third, what are the options that the state has available to it to fund the obligations of paying the costs in the midstream project? When we look at the first of these three broader questions, there are four potential concerns that need to be addressed. Will the state's requirement to fund midstream costs result in an increased state funding commitment relative to what the state is committing to now? As a result, will the TransCanada exit result in an erosion of the state's borrowing capacity? Will the state's credit rating be adversely affected by this action? And what will be the long-term impact on TransCanada's buyout in terms of how the state's credit is perceived? Will that be perceived as a positive or a negative action from a credit perspective? If we look at the first of these potential concerns, which is whether the state's direct funding of the midstream costs will result in increased state commitments, it is important to recognize that under the existing arrangements, the state is already committed to paying the midstream project costs. And what do we mean by this specifically? We'll use some examples about how the project might evolve from this point forward. As you know, the project is currently in what is referred to as the pre-FEED stage or pre-front-end engineering and design, which is one of the earliest stages in the development of the project. If the project does not advance beyond this stage, if for whatever reason FEED is not reached, the state is committed to reimburse TransCanada under the existing arrangement, the PA, with interest. If the project advances past pre-FEED and enters into front-end engineering and design, the next stage, or FEED, and for whatever reason the project does not advance beyond the FEED stage, whether it's because it's deemed to be uneconomic by the participants or for whatever other reason, the state is again obligated to repay TransCanada with interest. If the project
Could you forward the slide on here that you're working off of?
Yeah. If the project successfully advances beyond the FEED stage and enters into the construction phase, and for whatever reason is unsuccessful in completing construction, which obviously would be a very bad outcome for the project. Again, the state is obligated to reimburse TransCanada with interest under the existing arrangement, and the future obligations as currently expected, the future contractual arrangements, which are expected to be entered into under the terms of the PA, which we will refer to in the rest of the presentation as the FTSA, which stands for the Firm Transportation Services Agreement, which is what the state will need to enter into following the precedent agreement. So if you look at these three scenarios where the project either does not advance past the pre-FEED stage, does not advance past the FEED stage, or reaches construction and does not successfully complete such construction, in each one of these scenarios, the state is obligated to reimburse TransCanada. In other words, the state is taking on the risk of the development and construction stages of this project. If you compare this arrangement with the risk exposure that the state's other partners in the project have, the producers, ExxonMobil, BP, ConocoPhillips, for each one of them, development capital invested into the project during the pre-FEED, FEED, or construction stages, in the event that the project is not successful in proceeding, will be lost. Their capital is at risk, similarly to how the state's capital is at risk for the midstream component, which TransCanada is funding. Right? So if one way to think about it is that, in effect, the state is borrowing money from TransCanada, because their role is more akin to one of a lender rather than an equity investor, in the sense that the state is the one who is retaining the risks that typically are retained by equity investors in putting equity capital at risk during the development and construction stages. The next question is, what happens if the project is successful in advancing past the development stage and through the construction stage and successfully enters into operations? In that scenario, under the expected terms of the FTSA with TransCanada, the state will be still obligated to repay TransCanada's capital invested during the development and construction periods. But in this instance, instead of repaying it in a lump sum, it will be repaid over time through a transportation tariff, which the state will commit to pay TransCanada. This tariff will have a component in it which is referred to as the capacity reservation charge, which includes a repayment of TransCanada's capital invested with return. So one way to think about this is that the repayment of TransCanada's capital is as if you're repaying principal on a loan, and the return component of the tariff is similar, akin to the interest component of a loan. The repayment of TransCanada's capital in the tariff through the capacity reservation charge occurs through an annual depreciation charge, which is, again, similar to a principal installment, periodic principal installment of a loan, with the return on TransCanada's capital being the interest. Separately, as part of the tariff, the state will be obligated to pay TransCanada's operating cost of the midstream segment, which, if the state were to own this segment directly, the state will be paying directly by itself. But under the existing arrangement with TransCanada, the state is still paying the operating costs indirectly by paying the tariff, which includes a component that represents the operating costs incurred by TransCanada. So if you look at all of these scenarios, whether we're talking about the development period, the construction period, or the operational period, the state is obligated to ultimately repay the capital invested into the midstream. In other words, there is no incremental commitment by the state to fund the midstream capital that will result as a result of the decision to terminate the relationship with TransCanada. It's simply replacing one form of financing with another. It will be substituting a direct form of financing with an indirect form of financing through TransCanada, whereby in each case the state ultimately bears all the risk and has all the obligations and responsibilities for ultimately repaying and funding that segment. On the question of what will the effect be of this action on the state's borrowing capacity, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thank you, Vladislav. As we all know, the state has a limited borrowing capacity. The state has a lot of capital needs. So one of the things that we looked at immediately was, will the termination of the TC agreement erode the state's borrowing capacity? And as we've established already this afternoon, the TC exit will not incrementally increase the state's obligation. The state is already obligated to pay the cost of TC. Under the PA and under the anticipated cost of the FTSA, the state is going to be obligated to support its credit with the full faith and credit of the state, or what we call a general obligation, or in absence of that, a dedicated funding source. with TC went out and got financing, it would be relying upon the state's credit for ultimately reimbursement of its costs. We believe that the rating agencies, and as you know, the state is rated AAA by all three rating agencies, would consider this obligation to TC the same as if they were issuing debt. And so there will be no difference in terms of analyzing for the state's capacity because you're going to OTC or you're going to finance it directly. An example of this and how the rating agencies would appear is on page 6. Moody's Investor Service is one of the three major rating agencies that rates the state AAA, although, as many of you know, that Moody's has raised questions about how the state is going to handle its financial challenges. But this part here is dealing with a PPA, which is very similar to an FTSA. And you can see that the language indicates that the rating agencies are going to view that commitment that you made under the PA in TransCanada as the same as virtual debt. And as a result of that, there will be no difference in the analysis whether TC is part of the program or whether the state assumes it itself. The second question we've looked at is, as I've alluded to, will the state's credit rating be adversely affected by the TC's exit? First Southwest believes and advises that determination of TC's agreement in and of itself will not result in a downgrade of the state's credit rating. As we've talked, we have a couple reasons for that. Number one, there is no incremental additional cost to the state by terminating the TC agreement. Number two, as we will discuss throughout the day, and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford will also indicate, we believe there will be a substantial savings to the state as a result of terminating the TC agreement because we believe the state can finance at a lower cost of capital than TC. However, with or without TC, we estimate that the state is going to undergo credit rating pressure because you're going to have to finance a tremendous amount of money in a period where there's not going to be corresponding revenues. As we know, in terms of timing, we have to build the project and then the revenues flow. During that period, the state will have to issue a lot of debt, and we in fact expect that absent revenues, that that's going to put pressure on the state's credit rating. However, once the project becomes flowing and rating and revenues come in, the credit rating should be restored to their normal level. Once again, TC's exit and the elimination of the agreement should not in and of itself cause any downgrade in the state's credit rating. In addition to what we anticipate to be the savings, there's also a risk to maintaining this TC agreement. As Radoslav mentioned, TC is acting as a lender to this, to the financing under the current PA. Should anything happen, TC has the right to end that arrangement. And if TC chooses to end the arrangement, then the state will owe TC on a date very shortly thereafter all the monies that TC has expended plus all the fees and costs. Should that happen, the state would have to go out and borrow the money that has to pay for TC at a very quick time because it's unlikely you'll have that much cash on reserves. In that environment where we have a failed partner and perhaps a failed project, it could be very expensive to borrow money at that rate for that particular time. And we would try and avoid that situation for the state in going forward, and it's another advantage why we think the TC arrangement should be terminated.
So the next of the broad questions that we would cover today is, what is the cost that the state is expected to finance its share of the midstream project directly rather than indirectly to TransCanada, and how this cost would compare with what the state is committed to paying to TransCanada under the existing arrangement? First, it's in order to address this question, it is helpful to first do an overview of what the cost of capital arrangements are under the existing arrangement. If the PA is terminated and the state is obligated to reimburse TransCanada for its development costs, the additional interest component to which we have been referring to is at a rate of 7.1%. If provided that the state makes the payment within a time period specified in the PA. If the state does not make the payment within the specified time period, the interest rate is higher. If the project is successful in proceeding past the development and construction stages and enters into operations, as we described previously, the state will be paying a return on TransCanada's rate base in addition to repaying their capital, and that return is akin to what in a normal loan would be the interest rate. How is this return calculated? It's calculated on principles that are common in tariff setting mechanisms, using a concept of a deemed weighted average cost of debt and equity, weighted average cost of capital. And what we mean by weighted average debt and equity is that there's an assumed ratio between the debt portion of the capital and the equity portion of the capital. In the arrangements with TransCanada under the PA and the expected FTSA, that ratio changes over time. The specified ratio is 70 to 30, 70 debt, 30% equity, during the construction period and during the first two operating years, the first 2 years and from the what we refer to as the in-service date of the project. And beyond that period, after the first two operating years, it switches to 75% debt and 25% equity. The way the weighted average cost of capital is arrived at, but using these weighting of debt and equity, is by applying the 75% weighting of debt to the deemed cost of debt, which was set at the time of the execution of the MOU with TransCanada in 2013 at 5% rate, and the equity component was set at 12% rate. So you apply 75% to 5%, and you apply a 30% weighting to 12%, the equity component, in the operating period, or if it's the construction period, you apply a 70% weighting to the 5% cost of debt and 30% weighting to the 12% cost of equity, and you arrive at the weighted average cost of capital. To illustrate that, on slide 11, we're showing a table where we're showing two snapshots in time of what TransCanada's cost of capital is under this arrangement. The important fact to note is that the cost of capital under the TransCanada arrangement is not fixed. It varies with variations in the yield on a 30-year Treasury bond. So this is why I was referring to what the cost of capital was as of December 2013, which was the effective date of the MOU with TransCanada. On that date, the 30-year Treasury yield was 3.91%, which resulted in a weighted average cost of capital during the construction period and the first two operating years of 7.1%, and once the debt-to-equity ratio flips from 70-30 to 75-25 beyond that period, the 7.10 reduces to 6.75. Now, Treasury rates have declined since December of 2013. They're lower today. Over the last couple of months, they have been in the range of 290 to approximately 3. For the illustrative example we're showing, we have assumed 295. So assuming 295 30-year Treasury yield, the resulting weighted average cost of capital as a snapshot today for applicable to the period during the construction and through the first two operating years is what used to be 7.10 in 2013 is now 6.15. The 6.75 during the operating period as of 2013 is now 5.80. So the cost of capital has declined under the TransCanada arrangement because it's linked to the Treasury rates, which have declined. Now, how does that compare with what the state can achieve if it were to directly finance the midstream portion on its own? Steve can elaborate on that.
Thank you, Radoslav. As Radoslav mentioned, the rates that we're going to estimate financing change every day with the yield on the 30-year Treasury. So we picked a date, September 11th, back last month, and tried to compare what we estimated the cost would be to TC under the PA agreement, which would then be passed on to the state, versus what would happen if the state went out and borrowed itself. And that's what the chart on page 12 shows. We've shown, as Radoslav said, there's two different calculations, one in construction period and one in operating period, and that represents the red lines. And then the gray lines below represent what we estimate the cost would be for the state to assume these same obligations but finance it directly on its own. One of the things that we mentioned earlier was that the state's credit rating may decline as we issue so much debt without any corresponding revenues to match it. And so we ran through a number of different scenarios at different ratings. The state, as you know, is rated AAA, AAA, AAA from the three major rating agencies. But the graph shows that even if the state's credit rating declines to a rate of A1 or A minus A3, then the interest rates on the state's borrowing will still be less than what's under the PA agreement. I would remind the committee that the state hasn't been rated such a low rating since 1974, and that was right before TAPS began in that a similar circumstance. And so we would expect that it's unlikely that given the state's more sophisticated financial position that would fall to that level, but we wanted to show a dramatic drop just to demonstrate the resiliency of the state in terms of financing this. And as I said, under all these credit rating scenarios, the cost would be less than what it would be under the PA agreement that the state's under it now. The next question we looked at was how will the state fund its share of the midstream project costs? First of all, it's important to understand what those costs are. We divided the cost of the project into three different stages. The pre-FEED stage, which currently is estimated from 2014 to 2016, will be approximately $144 million. The FEED stage would last from 2016 to 2018 and be approximately $675 million. And the construction stage, which we expect to last from 2019 to 2026, would be a total of $13 billion. We've identified four different options that the state could consider in funding its amounts, as we mentioned in the previous slide. And we'll go through each one of these in details in a second. The legislature could appropriate from existing state funds, such as the Constitutional Budget Reserve, Earnings Reserve Fund, or another fund. The legislature could authorize the issuance of debt. The legislature could also authorize the pursuit of project financing. And finally, the legislature could authorize the pursuit of funding from other sources, such as LNG buyers and other potential equity investors. In terms of appropriating state funds, I don't need to tell you guys how to do that, since that's part of your daily job. We estimate that, for example, if the legislature elected to use the CBRF, that the CBRF would be depleted in 2018 or 19, given the current funding requirements. Utilizing the CBRF to finance the TC reimbursement and midstream financing would accelerate the depletion of the CBRF by approximately 3 to 5 months. And as you know, the CBRF is heavily the function of the price of oil, and so we've run a couple of scenarios in terms of where the price of oil would be. But we estimate that by using that to fund these operations, the CBRF would be completed 3 to 5 months earlier. And we conclude, therefore, that we could use the CBRF to fund these initial costs and at least a portion of the FEED costs, but there just isn't enough money there now to fund the construction costs. We ultimately expect that as we take out the short-term funding used for pre-FEED and FEED, that the CBRF would be reimbursed for those expenditures. So it's essentially a temporary loan to the project, which would be earning interest, and then ultimately be reimbursed. A second funding source could be the issuance of state debt. The legislature could authorize the state debt, and there are many different forms in which that state debt could occur, either through a general obligation bond or an appropriation-backed bond. Bonds, as you know, the credit market's very large and could be used to finance FEED and the ultimate construction cost of the project. There's generally a long-term repayment consistent with the life of this project. We would certainly recommend 20 to 30 years in terms of amortizing this cost. There are timing implications. As you know, a general obligation bond would require a vote of the people to authorize that. An appropriation bond would not.
So in addition to state funds and state debt, the legislature could also authorize the pursuit of project financing for the AKLNG project. Project financing means that lenders would look primarily to the project's cash flows and assets as security for repayment rather than the state's credit or the state's funds. Project finance is a very common form of financing for LNG projects in the U.S. and globally. Project finance requires the project's commercial structure to be in place. So what that means is the key project agreements, such as agreements with producers and LNG buyers, contractors, and others, must be executed in order for project financing to actually be implemented. The commercial structure also needs to be bankable in project finance lenders' eyes, so they would need visibility on project cash flows and clarity on their security package. Because project financing is secured by the cash flows of the project, it is not available to fund FEED costs, because FEED occurs prior to the completion of the key agreements and visibility around all of the cash flows. Importantly, the ability to use project financing for the AKLNG project may require constitutional amendment to allow the pledging of LNG sales proceeds as lender collateral, which is currently not permitted under the state's constitution. As the project's commercial structure has not yet been agreed and is still evolving, it's premature to evaluate the extent to which project finance could be a viable source of funding. Other potential funding sources include LNG buyers themselves or other equity investors. The legislature could authorize the pursuit of discussions or around a co-investment from LNG buyers or other equity investors, such as infrastructure investors. LNG buyers or off-takers have often participated as equity investors in LNG projects around the globe. Any pursuit of LNG buyers as a co-investor would need to be made in coordination with the state's marketing plan. Importantly, LNG buyers or other equity investors could share the project development risks, and these funding sources could provide a source of funding in the event a producer withdraws from the project. At this stage of the project's development, it's premature to evaluate the extent to which LNG buyers or other equity investors could be viable sources of funding. So we've laid out a illustrative high-level funding scenario to demonstrate that the ultimate financing plan will likely include a combination of funding sources and will need to be sequenced appropriately based on the phase of the project. So, for example, the state could use short-term funding sources, such as the CBRF, to fund the project, the state's share of the project, through FEED. And then as the project reaches FID and commences construction, the state could arrange its long-term financing, such as GO debt that Steve described, or project financing, or some combination thereof. In the event that the state utilized the CBRF through FEED, it could use the proceeds from the long-term financing to repay the funds that it used from the CBRF. I'll pass it back to Radoslav for some concluding remarks.
Thank you, Justin. In conclusion, we would like to revisit again what we think are the important takeaways from the analysis that we have done on the financing implications of the TransCanada exit. First, there is an immediate impact on the state financial position, in that the state will be required to fund the reimbursement to TransCanada of its development costs plus interest in a relatively short time frame. However, TransCanada's exit will not result in any incremental financial commitments that the state is undertaking, because the state is already committed to paying the midstream costs indirectly through TransCanada and ultimately repaying the capital that TransCanada is investing, not very dissimilar from what would be on a lending arrangement whereby TransCanada is the lender instead of the state going directly to the lending market. There will be no incremental impact on the state's long-term credit rating and borrowing capacity, because the financing community and the rating agencies will perceive the obligations that the state has undertaken under the arrangement with TransCanada as being essentially equivalent to already having borrowed those funds. So there are no incremental financial obligations or commitments. Therefore, there should be no incremental impact on the credit rating solely as in borrowing capacity, solely as a result of TransCanada exiting the deal. And the cost at which the state can fund its share of the midstream project costs directly as opposed to indirectly through TransCanada should not be, should be at best, or at worst, should be no greater than what the state is committing to paying TransCanada under the existing arrangement. And in fact, we think that there's a good chance that it will be more cost advantageous to the state to borrow directly rather than indirectly, because as First Southwest has projected, the interest rate is expected to be lower if the state were to borrow directly rather than indirectly. And finally, also very importantly, the state has a range of financing options available to it to fund its share of the midstream project costs directly rather than indirectly. Of course, the commercial structure is still evolving. The state is still in negotiations with the producers on what that commercial structure will look like. Any financing plan will have to be carefully tailored to whatever the commercial structure ultimately emerges from these discussions. Therefore, it's premature at this point to craft a specific, detailed, customized financing plan. At the appropriate time when the state is creating a detailed financing plan, such a financing plan will have to be obviously carefully considered, appropriately sequenced, such that short-term funding is implemented and utilized before long-term funding is available, the appropriate risk allocation and the state's preferences are taken into consideration as the legislature considers what is the most appropriate financing plan. But what we have advised the state is that there is a range of options that are potentially viable that the state can utilize to fund its share of the midstream project costs. Thank you.
Steve, any wrap-up?
I think we're available to answer any questions, Mr. Representative Newman.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a series of three questions, if I may. First, how long have Greengate, First Southwest, and Lazard been on contract to the state of Alaska in this regard?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. Greengate has been under contract in respect of AKLNG since July of this year.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, First Southwest was retained through an RFP process through the Department of Revenue, I believe in October of 2014, so almost a year, over a little bit over a year.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, Lazard has been retained by the state as of September 2014, I believe.
Okay. And so knowing that, the follow-up, sir, thank you, following up, knowing that's been your engagement in the project, how much of that time has been spent on focusing on TransCanada's, on the buyout provisions and the termination and the resulting financial decisions?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'm not sure that I have a precise allocation of the timing difference, but I would say probably the last few weeks since we were asked to look at this issue and what the financing implications would be.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, as you will be discussed in a later presentation, the arrangement with TC offered what we call certain off-ramps. There are logical conclusions, conditions and time elements in the time where it would be logical for the state to end the agreement. And that one of those off-ramps is coming up now, and so that is why we have focused on the opportunity and made an analysis for the state to determine how much it would cost to quote-unquote take that off-ramp by ending the solution. So it's much more of a logical progression in terms of operating under the PA.
But about how much time have you been focusing on that off-ramp then? When did you start?
Certainly been the last 12 weeks.
12 weeks, okay.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think the point is that the important point to take into consideration is that the state's strategic choice to make the decision on whether or not to terminate the relationship with TransCanada is something that is taken by the recommendation to make that choice is something that the state team has considered over time, knowing that the potential off-ramp is existing, evaluating whether the TransCanada relationship is beneficial or not. However, the financing implications of that decision is the narrow topic that has been the function of our review, which we have been asked to look at relatively recently. But, of course, we're not focusing on the strategic considerations as to whether that decision should be taken or whether it's a good idea to take it and when to take it.
Right. And before you answer, sir, my last question, I'll be follow-up, sir. Yeah, my point is to find out how much of your expertise has been focused on the off-ramps and the buyouts and the financing of those buyouts and the implications of those buyouts versus the success case of how to find out and make it work. I hear you say 12 weeks. I heard you say, the last few weeks, 12 weeks, and...
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we've spent probably the majority of the past couple months on this issue. We've been engaged for a little over a year. Most of Lazard's focus is more broadly around the financing alternatives for the state, and the long-term financing in particular.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think on the question of the success of the project as opposed to the termination of the existing arrangement with TransCanada, we think that the recommendation to terminate the relationship with TransCanada, as will be explained also from a strategic perspective by Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, is entirely consistent with the successful outcome of this project. This is consistent with the view that the state will be in a better position, more cost-advantageous position, if it pursued direct ownership of the midstream component rather than indirect ownership. So it's a matter of cost of financing rather than success or lack of success.
Okay. Last follow-up. Last one.
Yeah, let's get some other members here if we can, Dan. Or is it specific to this topic?
It is, actually. Specifically my last question. Thank you for indulgence, sir. You said, are you relying on a recommendation or an actual decision that's been made?
We have been, Representative Sadler to the chair, we have been asked to provide advice on what the potential implications to the state would be if that decision were to be taken.
So it's contingent. It's not yet a decision, correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thompson and Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I don't know where I'm headed with this. Given our current oil prices, is it prudent for us to address our risk exposure in the short term or mid-long term? I mean, I'm curious on what effect that has on it.
Representative Thompson, the state has a number of financing needs, which we could detail, but I know that the committees are well aware of all the financial projects that could, in fact, be used in terms of capital. There is a substantial amount of risk in the state budget due to the oil, and we believe that this is just one small component of the decisions that are facing the legislature in terms of how to allocate its resources.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did you take in consideration if this were to qualify for the permanent fund, since they look at projects like this, well, not maybe like this one, but, you know, commercial buildings, all the rest, and if the money, because, again, it's the resource of the state, and a certain percentage, like the 7% or whatever it was, would go back into the permanent fund, how that would impact our credit rating and all the rest if it were to come from there versus the CBR?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the answer is yes. The permanent fund could be used as a source of financing, and the use of the permanent fund would, in fact, lower the cost of the financing to the state, and we would be able to provide the permanent fund with the capital. So that's one of the options that we have analyzed, and it falls under the broader fund of state funds.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And then also, what would that do to our so then it would have no impact on our credit rating, because our credit rating wouldn't just be on this project, but if we have other loans, which my understanding is we have quite a few, that if our credit rating starts being lowered, it impacts not just this project, but any others that we have out there that are on variable rates. Is that true?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, that is correct, that the lowering of the state's credit rating would affect not only this project, but all the other projects that state is borrowing for. And yes, it is also true that if this permanent fund financed this entire project, that we would not have any effect on the state's credit rating.
And with that, Mr. Chair, I don't know whether it's your intent or not, but I know we've had the question before, but I'd like to know why or why not this wouldn't fit underneath a project that they would look at. Because, again, I think one of the biggest complaints we've had is that we invest in everywhere but Alaska. And if this is a good project, I would think that would be something that they would want to be a part of.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. So, gentlemen, could we also get, committee get any information that you've provided on your reports to the administration? Can we get copies of those reports and information that you provided to the different departments within the administration? If you can send them through the chair, then we'll get them distributed so we can start getting and looking at the assumptions. And what I'd like to also get is your baseline on what you're basing your assumptions on, you know, the financial assumptions that you're basing them on. So if we can get that information, I'd appreciate that. Representative Guttenberg and Anguera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I'll ask a question. I don't know who wants to take it, but I'll just throw it on the table. But first, I'd like to say the state's approaching a milestone on this contract. If you had not been here or ready to present us with these financial options, you wouldn't have been doing your due diligence, nor have with the administration. So we had to be here some way to have these options, whether what is the best thing to do, whether buyout is appropriate or it isn't, or it's a revenue neutral thing. But as I go through this list, this presentation, and it from this morning's presentation, it seems like every option, every time there's a choice, it's beneficial for the state to buy out. I mean, and sometimes that raises a flag. It's like every time it's the benefit of the state to opt out, to buy TransCanada out. It even seems like, and I don't know if it's permissible for TransCanada to charge us interest when the interest that they're borrowing money on, that we're paying that, and then we're paying them interest on top of that for that money, so we're paying double interest, and it's still financially in the state's best interest to buy out TransCanada. So what would have to change? I mean, it seems like, to me, it's a no-brainer, and I'm looking for the reasons not for the other side to why not do this. What would have to change, or what analysis would have to be done that it would look like it isn't a good option for the state to do?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I think it will be beneficial for the members of the committee to consider the broader picture rather than the purely narrowly focused financial aspects of the decision, of the financial implications of it. It will be therefore beneficial for you to hear Deputy Commissioner Rutherford's presentation, which will talk about these broader aspects from a strategic standpoint. Why does the state think it's a good idea and is making the recommendation to terminate the relationship with TransCanada now? And rather than focusing simply on the financial considerations, because there are obviously pluses and minuses to the arrangement with TransCanada, and the evaluation needs to be performed in time, taking into consideration all the pluses and all the minuses, looking at the broader picture. So I would suggest that perhaps that question is better considered after you have had a chance to consider the presentation by Deputy Commissioner Rutherford.
Okay, so let me just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So just looking at the financial aspects, never mind project, larger issues of the project. So financial advice, because you're pretty neutral on this and what you're saying, just from a financial advisor position, is it as black and white as it looks like from what you presented to us?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, when we look at the when we assess the various risks that the state is exposed with or without TransCanada, when we look at the commitments that the state is taking with or without TransCanada, when we look at the cost that the state will be incurring in terms of interest costs of funding directly, indirectly through TransCanada, or directly on its own credit. It seems to us that the conclusions are quite strong. There are many strong arguments to support the recommendation that this is a good decision to be made. So to I usually hesitate to say that something is a black or white question, because very few questions are black or white, but the arguments that can be made in favor of a termination of the TransCanada arrangement from a financing perspective, we think are very strong.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. So is this standard boilerplate type of contracts that we have with TC, or are we plowing through new ground here with the arrangements that we've done in 138 to get to this point? Was that fairly basic in the industry operations, boilerplate type of work, or are we forging new ground here?
Representative Newman, the arrangement with TransCanada in terms of the type of tariff will be paid to TransCanada, how the tariff is calculated, the type, the methodology for calculating the rate of return that the state will be paying to TransCanada is consistent with what you would see in other similar arrangements. The financing aspects of the arrangement, whereby TransCanada is funding the state's share of the midstream under the existing arrangement, is, you could say, somewhat uniquely tailored to this project.
Somewhat unique. And what I'm trying to get to is measuring risk. And you said the funding arrangements were somewhat unique. And so that's something we're going to probably have to look a little bit stronger, because it's not your standard boilerplate. Yeah. So when you look at that risk and how we're going to share that, I guess this is a question for each of you. Is the risk proportionate for all the parties, or is the state or one party taking more risk in one point or another?
As Representative Newman, as we describe in a portion of our slides, the risk allocation under the existing arrangement with TransCanada is such that the state is committed to paying the cost of the midstream project under practically every scenario about success or failure of the project throughout its stages of development, construction, and operation. So in that sense, the risk allocation is indeed very one-sided, such that the state is taking practically all of the risks.
Yeah. And we don't need to get this now, but could you send us some information on what those risks would be and how we would measure those risks? I mean, we're entering into a partnership with other partners here, and you just said that we're taking a larger risk on this. And I want to know why and what we can do to manage those risks.
Representative Newman, I want to clarify one of the things that Radoslav said. When we talk about the state taking all the risks, we're taking all the risk under the TransCanada agreement. The other three project partners, BP, Conoco, and Exxon, are also taking the same risks as we are. We were only talking about the limited risk in terms of versus TransCanada and the state, as opposed to the other project partners who are also at risk.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
I've got some more questions, but I want to make sure other members have an opportunity. Representative Guerra and then Kawasaki.
Thank you. I'd like to quantify the value that you see in the state buying out TransCanada. It's been the theme of your presentation, but I want to see if we can quantify it some. So first, just on the last on Representative Newman's question, we're taking the risk if we don't buy out TransCanada, because if the project fails, we owe them all their money plus essentially a 7% profit on top of that. Is that the risk you're talking about?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Let me try and see if you can quantify this extra value you have seen in us purchasing out TransCanada. And this will either be a back-of-the-napkin calculation, and I'd really like a more accurate calculation to come maybe in writing later on. But on the tariff, if the state buys out TransCanada and we finance at a favorable rate like you've presented, how can you quantify that compared to us leaving TransCanada in the project and we pay them through their tariff charge to us? My understanding from past pipeline hearings we've had is that a pipeline owner gets about a 12%, 14% rate of return. I don't know if that's true under this project. So how would you quantify the value to the state between us financing it at what you say is lower financing or us paying TransCanada through their tariff if we leave them in?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the rate of return that the state would be paying to TransCanada via the tariff under the expected terms of the FTSA are a function of the weighted average cost of capital that is specified in the contractual arrangement with TransCanada. So, yes, you are correct that the equity component of the weighted average cost of capital, which is typically around, you know, 12% or so, was set as of December 2013 at 12%. It varies with the yield on 30-year Treasury bonds. Today, it's about a percentage point lower than that. However, you cannot look at the equity component in isolation. There is a weighted average debt and equity component. The debt component is weighed between 70 and 75%. The equity component is weighed between 25 and 30%. So the weighted average cost of capital, if taken together, if we go back to our slides, was as of December 2013, was 7.10 in the construction period and 6.75 during the operating period. As a result of the lower Treasury yields today, today those same rates are 6.15 or 5.80 during the operating period. Now, we of course do not know where Treasury rates will be in the future, but the important point to make is that Treasury rates increasing or decreasing affects both the return that the state is committing to pay to TransCanada and the state's cost of capital, because Treasury rates move all interest rates up or down.
Representative Garrow, through the chair, I know that you've requested, we've estimated that the annual savings, and you'll hear more in the presentation that follows because Black & Veatch has run their model, to be approximately $400 million a year in terms of savings.
Up to
$400 million a year in terms of savings. Obviously, if you put that over the life of the project, you're going to get a very large number. But Black & Veatch and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford will talk about that when they make their presentation.
Thank you. A second area of value, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Garrett, if we can keep that. And I just want to remind folks here, just a little housekeeping on who else is presenting today. We have these gentlemen for us until 3 o'clock today, and we'll be hearing from Black & Veatch later. I know that that was posted that we'd be having them, but I want to make sure we have plenty of opportunity to talk to these gentlemen while we've got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Garrett, but we also have a Kawasaki, Edgman, Munoz, Gaddis, and everybody else in line. So
it's actually just one other area. So that's your estimated state savings if we finance. And then have you done a calculation if the state leaves TransCanada in at their current share and we go through pre-feed and we go through feed and then the project fails at that point? We owe them 7% plus everything they paid. If we now purchase them out, we avoid that penalty. Have you calculated can you give me a guesstimate of how much we would save in those two scenarios where the project fails after feed in the scenario where the state has purchased out TransCanada or where TransCanada remains in its current position?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, we have I don't have that number with me, but I would be delighted to provide it to you following the hearing.
Thank you. If you could send them to the chair, I would appreciate that for all members.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, the one thing to point out on this question is that the magnitude of the obligation and therefore the magnitude of the savings depends on the timing of when a potential reimbursement occurs. Obviously, the later in the development stage this occurs, or the later in the construction period this occurs, the magnitude of the reimbursement will be greater, and therefore the interest that goes along with that reimbursement will be greater. Consequently, the savings associated with the interest component of the reimbursement will be greater. So you have to look at the range of scenarios, whether this occurs now or whether it occurs next year, whether it occurs in 2020, and we can provide that.
Through the chair. Just one final question.
You say that a lot, but yep. Representative Garrett.
It's our Representative Sadler final question. in trying to determine the difference between the two, if the state buys TransCanada out and it fails after feed, or TransCanada stays in and we pay them the 7% interest after feed, assuming those time frames are right and we know that they're guesstimates, do we calculate 7%? The 7% payment would be on the estimate of roughly $820 million over that 4 years.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the important consideration in that scenario is that several factors have to be taken into account. One is the differential interest cost that the state will be paying on the interest portion of the reimbursement versus what the state would have been paying if the state had financed those same costs directly on its own credit. An additional consideration is if that termination occurs at a sufficiently late stage in the development process such that the payment is large and therefore the state has to borrow in order to make it rather than using its own funds, as Steve pointed out, such borrowing to fund a one-time lump sum large payment may have to be incurred by the state at a time of adverse credit conditions to the state, because at that point in time the lending community would be aware of a potentially failed project, and therefore the cost to the state of borrowing to fund that reimbursement are unknown at this point, because we do not know what has been the underlying cause of the failure of the project. We would not know what the circumstances could be at the time, but as a result, the state's credit could be affected quite negatively. So it's difficult to predict what exactly the credit conditions would be under a range of scenarios of failure in the future. However, the credit environment will certainly not be as positive as it is today, where there is an expectation that the project hopefully will succeed. At that point, it will be known that there's a problem with the project, which is why the project has failed, and therefore the reimbursement obligation has been triggered.
Representative Garrow, through the chair, the answer is the amount that would be at any one time is going to be a function of the many factors that Radoslaw said, and also the nature of the cash flow. So we may be spending more earlier in the feed process or later in the feed process. And TransCanada advances the funds, and then we reimburse TransCanada. We can certainly provide an analysis and detail the assumptions for you, but I hesitate without going through all the assumptions to make sure that I'm responding to your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki, followed by Representative Aizman.
Thank you. I just have two brief ones. When we talked about Senate Bill 138, this was in 2014, part of the discussion about having TransCanada involved at all was that they brought something materially to the table, being a $40 billion company and things like that. And so you're saying, and then having the credit backing too. So you're basically saying that the credit rating, our credit rating, won't be impacted. And so I'm getting that. It was just a little bit different than what was said in previous administration.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, you raised two issues. We just do the finances. And so your first point is something that I would suggest you take up with the Black and Veatch and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, who is going to follow us. But as Radoslaw said, from the very narrow focus of a financial commitment and financial obligations, we believe very strongly that the state can finance that obligation at a lower cost by itself than through the TransCanada agreement.
And then one follow-up, and then...
Representative Kossack.
Part of having a partner like TransCanada was so that current cost overruns would be taken up by them. Wouldn't a credit agency have difficulty saying that now the cost overruns will be borne directly by the state?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the cost overruns are borne by the state, with or without TransCanada, because the state is obligated to reimburse TransCanada in the event of a failure for all of their capital invested, even in the event of cost overruns, or if the project successfully enters into the operational stage, the tariff that the state will be paying to TransCanada adjusts upwards to take into account the actual cost spent. So therefore, the state is bearing the risk of cost overruns. Again, both with and without TransCanada.
I guess just to follow up on that, but one is more immediate versus, you know, the long term of the pipeline contract. So I guess it's, wouldn't a credit agency look at that and say, well, you're going to have cash out sooner rather than later?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, yes, sir, that is correct. But one of the issues that we highlighted under the TransCanada agreement is that the state has very little control about whether TransCanada decides to participate in the project. And at any time, they could decide to exit, and the state would be forced to come up with a tremendous amount of money over time. But one of the underlying pinnings of the original agreement was that, yes, TransCanada would fund the early parts of the project, and the state would repay that funding over time, making a more level stream. But what we have found is that there's a cost to doing that, as you would expect from anything, any lender in that position, and the state's taking all of the risk, paying the cost of TransCanada as a lender, and once again, purely from a just financial aspect, that is a more expensive proposition than having the state do it itself.
And Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, if I may elaborate on Steve's response. When Steve went over at a high level at the potential funding options that the legislature could authorize going forward with respect to the midstream component of the project, a key element of that analysis is that if existing funds such as the CBRF are used, CBRF cannot be used necessarily for the long-term investment throughout the construction period because funds are simply not there. So the state on its own would have to borrow the funds, whether utilizing state debt or project finance, in order to fund its share of the project costs. However, the state is already borrowing from TransCanada, under the existing arrangement. So the net effect to the state is very similar, right? If the state is borrowing directly on its own credit, the lenders from whom the state is borrowing are providing the funds to the state, therefore not affecting the state's cash position, and then ultimately the state is obligated to repay those lenders, just like the state is borrowing effectively funds from TransCanada and committing to repaying them.
Okay. Yeah. And then I did have a question about the financing part, just brief.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the back of the Lazard report, it gives some examples of some big LNG projects, and a lot of them are like Gorgon's 47% Chevron, 25% Exxon, 25% Royal Dutch Shell, and then a handful of Japanese gas companies. And it's kind of similar. All those profiles are similar. Is that what we are expected? Are we expected to see something similar in the future where it's a couple big players and then a big row of small players that the state would have to negotiate with?
Representative.
To get LNG buyers and equity investors.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I think it's too early to tell exactly how things are going to play out with the financing. Certainly the reason we raised LNG buyers as a potential funding source is because they have participated in some other LNG projects globally. When you asked about the participation of other producers or strategic partners in the projects, everything we're talking about here is related to the state's roughly 25% interest in the overall project. So this assumes that there are the three other producers that are partnered with the state on this project would fund their proportion of it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Munoz, followed by Gaddis.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation today. It's very informative. Could you speak to the cash flow on the project should we move forward with TransCanada as it's currently structured? The cash flow to the state of Alaska is much greater under this scenario as it is with TransCanada. Could you speak to the kind of the breakdown of percentage of potential cash flow between the partners?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I would suggest that you take into consideration the presentation that will be provided by Black & Veatch, who have performed the modeling on precisely that topic. They will have some, they will show you some results as a which addresses precisely your question.
So in relation, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In relation to that presentation, I understand that the potential cash flow to TransCanada is relatively small compared to its investment, its $7 or $8 billion investment. Could you, do you agree with that presumption, or could you speak to that, please?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
So relative to the upfront cost, the $8 billion in upfront cost, 25% of the pipeline, 25% of the GDP, the relative cash flow percentage to TransCanada is between 1 and 7%. Could you speak, is that a fair deal for the state? Is it fair for TransCanada? Is it overly favorable to TransCanada?
The Representative Munoz, through the chair, the cash flow to pay to TransCanada depends on the scenario that we're looking at, right? If the project is successful in reaching operations, what the state will be paying TransCanada is the tariff, which will be in exchange for them providing the transportation services on the midstream component of the project. That tariff will be set by reference to a number of inputs that go into that calculation, including the amount of capital spent, including the cost of capital to TransCanada as set under the arrangements and the provisions that we described, the operating costs of the pipeline, et cetera. The net effect of the on the state's cash flow position of the state's revenue receipts from selling its share of the gas, net of all of the state's costs, including the cost of funding and paying the tariff payment to TransCanada in the case where TransCanada stays in the project, or alternatively paying the state's debt service if the state were to directly finance that share, is what has been estimated by Black & Veatch to be up to $400 million per year, and they can elaborate on that analysis. But that's essentially the estimated impact is up to $400 million per year.
Yeah. And in follow-up to that number, do you know what approximately what percentage of that $400 million is the transportation cost and not, you know, the cost of capital?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I would suggest that Black & Veatch was actually done the modeling answer that question. Yeah.
And then finally, Mr. Chairman, one last question. Could you speak to TransCanada's reputation as a pipeline builder, and could you tell me if there are examples where TransCanada, at a relatively developed stage of a project, has pulled back on a project?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, TransCanada is a well-known pipeline company with a lot of experience in pipelines. I'll point out, as you would see in more detail in the presentation to come from Deputy Commissioner Rutherford and from Black & Veatch, that the role of the construction contractor for the pipeline segment has not yet been determined. It's not necessarily going to be TransCanada. TransCanada's role, as we know it today, is not to be the construction contractor on the pipeline component, but under this existing arrangement to essentially provide a financing vehicle to the state. And the presentation by Deputy Commissioner Rutherford and by Black & Veatch will elaborate on the strategic aspects of TransCanada's presence or absence from the project.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean this to be a leading question, but I think I've heard the three of you collectively say that it'd be your professional recommendation to the administration, by extension to us as a legislature, that it makes more sense from a financing perspective to actually terminate the relationship with TransCanada. And I just want to get clarification that that's truly what you're here today saying.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, I think that's correct. If we limit the scope of that question to our expertise, which is the financial aspects of the agreement, we would recommend to the administration that that agreement be terminated.
Then, Mr.
Go ahead, Representative.
Chairman, just if we could slip back to slide 12, a couple of slides back. In terms of looking at, I think the statement was made that the worst case scenario here would take us back to 1974 when you know, we're building the TAPS pipeline and the state's bond rating had been all the way down to A minus A3. But is there a scenario where you know, the gas line actually the timeline goes further out into time in the sense that you know, it doesn't happen in the next few years. Maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 15 years by the time we actually get into the construction phase or what have you. And the state's financial situation deteriorates given our long-term deficits and so forth. But what kind of probability would you assign to the cost of state's capital, that bottom line, they're even going further out? It's a bit of a confusing question, but where I'm trying to get at with all this is that at least in my limited view of all things global and with the natural gas industry, there's a pretty good scenario that this pipeline doesn't get built, not in the immediate future anyhow, so that all these assumptions that we're building are on a certain timeline that we have before us, but we could take that timeline and extend it much further out. We all know the state's deficit situation, that we've got two of our three credit rating agencies already sort of putting us on watch, and it was a pretty dire consequences if we don't take certain actions coming up very soon here as a state. So I guess I'm just trying to get your take as to, you know, I mean, this bottom line could actually go further out if you assign certain assumptions to it.
Representative Edmund, through the chair, that's correct. We did a set of scenarios of what we thought was likely, but it certainly doesn't encompass all the possibilities. The spread between the ratings and the cost between them are a function of a number of factors. One is the overall interest rate at the time, but also the spread that the market perceives in terms of credit quality. And that spread both widens and narrows over time, depending upon the market, interest rate, and a variety of financial factors. So this is one representative example. We believe, however, though, as interest rates go up and down, and if credit spreads remain the same, that this same relationship would hold true, that, in fact, under these scenarios, the state would be able to finance at a less expensive cost than on its own rather than through TransCanada.
Representative, through the chair, if I may elaborate on Steve's response, there is, as Steve pointed out, while there are a number of factors that go into the determination of what the state's credit position might be, and certainly it is conceivable that the state's credit position might, for a number of factors, might be worse than is contemplated by this chart here. Could be because there's never a gas pipeline project, because the oil revenues declined precipitously. It could be a number of factors, right? In such a situation would not be what we would characterize as credit positive if there is no pipeline and we have a very significant decline in oil revenues. But the impact on the state from such a scenario, as it pertains to the issue that we're discussing today, is the same whether TransCanada is in or out. Right? Because in such an adverse credit scenario, whether the state had chosen to fund the midstream portion of the project indirectly through TransCanada or directly on its own credit would still leave the state in essentially the same position, which would be in that scenario a bad one, but nevertheless not adversely affected solely as a result of the choice made on whether to fund through TransCanada or not. So,
so just real quick,
Representative.
Then to conclude, could you put a scenario together with the assumptions that you have today and, with assumptions that you might concoct for tomorrow that might put the state in a situation where that's 7.1% cost of capital by TransCanada might be attractive?
Representative Edmund, I don't want to prejudice the through the chair. I don't want to prejudice the analysis, but I certainly can try and run additional scenarios at your direction and come up with the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Gaddis, followed by Senator Kalin. Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to understand, Mr. Shipkoff, your careful conditioning of your answer to Representative Edgman's earlier question. I'm concerned here generally that the presentation focuses on one side of the ledger, that is the cost of TransCanada's participation in the deal as envisioned now, the cost of the state with or without TransCanada's participation in the future, and by implication, the benefits of a higher state of Alaska equity position. In my view, a full assessment of the implications of the TransCanada buyout demands a full analysis of the state's increased risk as an expanded equity partner, which is kind of the questions Representative Garrow is asking. Speaking generally, I think, what are the risks involved if we take a bigger piece of this pie? You gave a careful answer about all the ROI and so forth. So I guess the answer is either give it now or I look forward to the analysis that you promised us, Mr. Cantor. That's not my question. My question, however, is I'm learning the game here. So the question is that I think a lot of Alaskans and a lot of legislators want to answer pretty baldly is, has there ever been any discussion by any of the parties, administration, legislators, departments, you guys, about using any portion of the permanent fund corpus, or if there's any way in which you envision using the permanent fund to finance this under any of the division's sequences or scenarios? I'd like to know about, I think the people Alaska need to know about that. Is the permanent fund being laid on the table? Because I noticed on slide 5, the first bullet there is a dedicated funding source acceptable to TC. So the large question, is the permanent fund in anyone's sights here?
Representative Sadler to the chair. I think given the magnitude of the project and the financial situation of the state, that it would be foolhardy to reject any possible solution. So what we've tried to do today is give you the broad outline of what we think and our best judgment would be ways for the state to finance not only the termination payment for TransCanada, but also your continuing participation in the project. There are a number of different alternatives within those broad categories, and certainly the permanent fund could be one of them. But we have not specifically offered the permanent fund a solution to anyone. We just know it's out there. And at your direction, we would certainly do more research.
Representative Sadler, I'd like to pass that information or that question over through Department of Natural Resources and the administration to make sure we've got those answers as soon as we can get them. Pat, get that? Thank you. I've got a couple here I'd like to talk about. Go back to page 6. Talks about the take or pay and the power purchase agreements, similar to the firm transportation agreements, to obligate the buyer to make the capacity charge payments regardless of output. And those agreements are scrutinized by the credit agencies. And that's been a concern that I've had for a while now. Some of the contracts, it's my understanding that contracts for 25 and 30 years for purchasers of gas, particularly in the Asian market, are starting to decline. They're wanting to move away from that, purchase out of spot market prices, negotiate out of long-term contracts. How do we see the state measuring out on this, and how are the rating agencies going to analyze that, knowing that that's what's coming, that's the future, this is where we're at now. But our plan looks at a 30-year plan on financing all this, but we don't even know what the price of our gas is, how we're selling it, who's buying it. How do you analyze the purchasing agreements or the buyers of the gas, their credit ratings? Because it would appear to me that their ratings or their information is the basis of what the state's leaning on. And if they're not proper and in place, it puts the state more at risk on that, because we still have to cover the costs even though we're not being able to sell the gas. How do you measure that out? In how much would the credit rating agencies scrutinize the purchasers of gas? There's several questions in there.
Representative Newman, thank you for your question. Let me deal with the last part, which is what will the rating agencies do and how will they examine the buyers? And the answer is that the rating agencies will examine whatever the agreements are to repay the bonds very carefully, and they will certainly go through and analyze what the credit nature and the financial position of the people who are agreed to purchase biogas, the particular nature of that contract will all be factors in terms of their rating. And obviously, the more financially secure the buyer, the less risk there is on the state. Part of that is just a negotiation process, and all these processes will take time. It's a little bit too early to analyze exactly what's going to happen because, as you know, we are still in the very beginning stages of the process. But it's certainly something we're focused on and we'll continue to examine as the project continues to move forward.
On that point, Mr. Cantor, could you get us information then? What are the possible alternatives that the state could face? You said there's several options that could be available. We're early into the process. Could you get the committee some information on any potential implications or what the state might be looking at into the future?
We certainly could. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Did you have an answer? Do you want to follow up on that? And then, again, I don't think we had the ability. What about the market into the future like that? Did I hear that right in some of the discussions that I've had with contracts for long-term contracts in the Asian market? Are they moving away from that?
Representative Newman, thank you for the question. From what we have heard from experts in the LNG marketplace and from our own observations through our experience and participation in financing these projects, for the most part, LNG projects continue to be implemented and financed on the basis of long-term sales and purchase agreements. However, there is the perception that there is a pressure on that model and that in the future there is an expectation that the sales contracts might see a greater proportion of shorter-term contracts. The buyers may become more fragmented. The credit rating of the buyers may be different than the one that historically has been the credit rating associated with LNG buyers, typically very strong, large Asian utility purchasers of LNG. That has not quite yet happened. There is a perception that the market is moving in that direction, but it has not quite materialized yet. It will be certainly something that the state, along with its partners, as they continue development of this project, will monitor and assess as part of the evaluation of the AKLNG project and what are the appropriate steps in managing that situation.
Would that increase the state's risk, I'm assuming?
Representative yes. Newman, yes. To the extent that the state's buyers are of lower credit rating than alternative buyers who have a higher credit rating, yes, that would increase the state's risk. However, simply because in the future the LNG market may look different than the way it looks now does not mean that necessarily, and there may be new players, there may be new buyers, that does not necessarily mean that the state will automatically have the lowest credit rating buyers or the worst buyers out there. It's a matter of carefully managing the marketing strategy, and that's something that the state, to get alongside with its partners, will be focusing on in the years ahead.
Thank you. Representative Sadler, followed by Guerra.
Thank you. Regarding the question of credit rating, I have a follow-up on that. My understanding is, and I was there when it was passed, SB 138 sets up a pretty clear process towards sanction of an AKLNG project. And I think the credit rating agencies factored in the fact that we had a process in place to do that. Now, over the last year or so, we have not made the progress that I expected to see towards a firm transportation services agreement. So does the failure to pursue the process and hit those benchmarks and hit those milestones, does that have any implications for our credit rating and the financing of project financing applications? I guess that is, does AKLNG appear less reliable now, and will that convert into a higher demand for higher return on investment, higher interest rates for our financing, and so forth?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there were a lot of questions there, sir. Allow me to respond to some of them, and if I do not get them all, please remind me of the ones that I've omitted. The rating agencies are concerned with many prospects. One is obviously the overall financial health of the state of Alaska, and I believe Representative Newman alluded to the fact that, as you did yourself, sir, that there are some challenges that the rating agencies have recognized in terms of what's going forward and how the state's going to handle their finances. To the extent that AKLNG has been offered as a possible solution to those finances, I think the rating agencies have recognized that that the increase in revenue that would refer from the project is very far out in the future. And so the so there is not an immediate impact on the state in terms of where things are. I think that it's fair to say that, and I think the governor mentioned it this morning, that the state is somewhat frustrated with the progress that has been made. But having said that, a slower progress also means a slower outlay of cash. And so the amount of cash obligations that the state has incurred on the project has not been as rapid as we anticipated. One of the issues that we raised in our presentation is that we've been able to finance the expenditure of funds through existing funds of the state. And as the CBRF gets depleted, and you may have other uses for the CBRF other than this project, we will have to monitor that, and the rating agencies will really become involved with this as the state has to go to the bond market.
Members, if we could, as we're setting up our questions, if we could restate the question specifically so that we all understand where everybody's coming from and the people who are trying to answer them get us the right answers. So as we set that up, let's finish up with what the question was. Thank you. Do you have any more, Representative Taylor?
No, nothing.
Okay. Representative Gare?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So many of us have been through sort of years of pipeline discussion, and one of the things I learned in one of the original discussions was something I didn't know back then, but as a shipper of gas, and so the state will be a shipper possibly in this contract, and we will ship through TransCanada's portion of the pipeline if they remain in this project. The shipper promises to send a certain amount of gas through the pipe, and if they don't send that gas, if they send less gas, they still have to pay for the portion of the pipe that they were supposed to send the gas through. So if you were supposed to send 30 BCF and you send 20 BCF, you still owe them the cost of shipping 30 BCFs. Is my understanding correct that that remains a risk to the state here, that we might have to pay for gas that we don't end up shipping as a shipper?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the commercial arrangements in the AKLNG project and the nature of the relationship between a participant's share of the gas and a participant's share of the capacity in the project is something that the Blackenbridge presentation and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford's presentation will address, but to and they can elaborate on that topic. But to very briefly answer your question, the concept of alignment in the AKLNG project is such that the share of the gas the participant has is supposed to be reflected into the share of the capacity. So if in a scenario where TransCanada were not in the project, the state would own the capacity, share of capacity throughout all of the components of the project. Therefore, there wouldn't be anyone to pay the tariff to. The state would be paying the tariff to itself. Right? If TransCanada remained in the deal, and this is the scenario that we have been evaluating from a financing perspective, whether what are the implications of them staying in the deal or not staying in the deal, the state would indeed be committed to paying a tariff to TransCanada to move the state's gas through the midstream components, which are the transmission lines from the fields, the gas treatment plant on the North Slope, and the main pipeline from the North Slope down south. I think the premise of your question is correct, which is that the state's obligation to pay that tariff to TransCanada is a fixed obligation. The state has to make that payment regardless of throughput, regardless of prices, regardless of the revenue that it generates on its share of the gas, which is why in our presentation we have analogized this to effectively being a debt commitment, because that fixed payment has to be made no matter what, just like someone who borrows needs to pay principal and interest on a predetermined schedule. This is where, in our analysis, the obligation that the state would be undertaking to TransCanada under the FTSA is analogous to debt obligation, which is why we have come to the conclusion that the state's credit would not be affected solely by whether TransCanada is in or not, because if the state, again, were to finance directly on its own credit, it would be incurring a debt service obligation. And under the current arrangements, we'll be committed to paying that fixed payment no matter what, just as you described in your question.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just make it more brief. For folks who didn't understand my long question and then your response to my long question, were the state to let TransCanada remain in the pipeline as an owner, as they are right now, that would include the risk that the state would have to pay for gas that's not available, and were the state to take that portion away and we would own it, the risk would be lower, or am I mischaracterizing that?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, to the extent that the state finances its share of the midstream, if the state were to own directly its share of the midstream, to the extent that it finances it with debt, it will incur a debt service obligation, again, which will be similar to the one under the arrangement with TransCanada. So then the question is, which of these payment obligations is higher? And based on the analysis that the First Southwest has performed, given the estimated borrowing cost of the state, the level of the obligation that the state will be paying under its own debt service, if the state were to directly finance on its own credit, its share would be lower. Therefore, the risk to the state would be lower, because in the event of lower revenues from which the costs to the state have to be paid, if those costs are less, the risk to the state of being in a net negative position are lower. The Black and Veatch presentation that you will see later on will address that particular point, which is that the state potentially is exposed to a greater risk of what is characterized as negative net back. In other words, the cost to the state exceed the revenues received from the sale of the state's gas. So, if the analysis concludes that the potential cost to the state of keeping TransCanada in are greater than the cost to the state if the state were to directly finance its share, and indeed that's the conclusion that we have, the risk to the state as a result of this greater cost that will be incurred if TransCanada were to stay in, from an economic perspective, is indeed greater to the state. You're correct.
Thank you.
I just want to pull into that one a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. All of us have had discussions amongst ourselves and industry leaders in the state about risk in the state's potential on bond ratings. You've stated that the buyout with TC puts the state in more risk. Is there enough risk there that would change the credit ratings assessment of Alaska?
Representative Newman, the buyout of TC at this time, in and of itself, we do not believe will affect the credit rating of the state. Obviously, the pipeline is a very large undertaking. We're also in the very preliminary stages of putting together the transaction for the pipeline. It's going to take many, many years. It's certainly going to be a focus of the working group and the people who are involved to examine what the risk of the state will be over time. It's very difficult, however, sitting here today, to predict what the state's risk on the pipeline is going to be, because we have to negotiate many, many agreements with the shippers, producers, and various equity partners. But certainly a focus of ours will be examining what risk is taking, the ability of the state to assume that risk, and how we can mitigate that risk going forward.
I kind of asked that question to set up my final question, is what we're looking again at these credit ratings, and I've talked to several bankers and some folks in real estate who deal with different financial obligations. And what do the credit agencies, what do they look at the state when they try and evaluate the state? Do they look at the assets of the state? I've recently heard the governor say that the state had about $100 billion in all in total assets, permanent fund, power cost equalization funds, all the funds that the state's got. Not all those funds would be available, you know, should the state not be able to make those payments. But we've heard in prior meetings and finance meetings, the state, the courts would probably find if the states pay their debt, go to the permanent fund dividend and other funding sources and that. So when the credit agencies are looking at the state of Alaska, and this has been a huge discussion in this building, because 1 or 2% or percentage points on billions of dollars is a tremendous amount of money. They look at the value of the assets of the states and the ability for the state to make their payments. Last year, our debt service was $228 million. So if I assume that the state's got $70 billion in assets available to cover their debt, and only $228 million in debt service this last year. They're after the money. They look at the money. Do they care about the state's politics? Do they care about whether the this continues to be part of the discussion, but as far as I'm concerned, why would they care about the state's politics on whether they move forward on this gas pipeline and how we go ahead with business? Or is it just strictly financial? Here's your assets, here's your payments, here's your ability to make your payments.
Representative Newman, that's a very good question. It's difficult to boil down the rating agency's analysis of the state into a finite box. Number one, each rating agency values different characteristics differently, so there's not uniformity across all three rating agencies. But on a broad brush effort, the rating agencies look at two factors. One is your ability to pay, which is, as you put the analysis, and the second is the willingness to pay. There have been situations where people have money, but in their infinite wisdom, should they decide not to pay, then that's not a very good credit rating score. So there's a variety of factors that go into the financial analysis of the ability to pay, but there's also a number of factors that go into the willingness to pay in terms of analysis of past commitments, what the future commitments are, and what is the willingness of the legislature and the government in general, both the administration and the legislature, to acknowledge those commitments and provide for those payments in the future.
It's an interesting your answer on that. Again, because it's the money. It's about the money.
It's not just about the money, sir. It's the ability to pay, which is the money and the financing. And quite honestly, the state has an excellent record in both areas, both the ability to pay and has demonstrated the willingness to pay. Hence, that's why you have a AAA rating.
And I guess the only reason I bring that up, and just for the members, and we've all had this discussion amongst ourselves, it's already entered into the discussion today a couple of times, with the use of permanent fund, funding state government, things that we've heard that if we don't do that, it could have an impact on the credit rating. And I was trying to get the answer of the credit ratings look at the state's ability to pay and our debt. Is that pretty much what we're looking at? I think the answer.
Well, Representative Newman, let me just offer you an example that when the federal government, who prints money, has their budget deficits and had the government shut down, one of the rating agencies, particularly Standard & Poor's, lowered their rating from AAA to A+, not because the federal government doesn't have the ability to pay, but because they question the willingness to pay. So I would point that as an example of situations where even the federal government, who can decide how much money it has on its own, doesn't have the willingness to come to a solution, a political solution to fund the government, then that caused a credit rating drop. So it's not just the ability to pay.
As you stated, the state of Alaska's got a very good record of paying their bills.
Yes, they do.
Representative Wilson, followed by Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to clarify something I heard. So you said that, I believe you said, that TransCanada could pull out at any time. And if they were to pull out, so let's say we just went ahead and went with TransCanada, and let's say in a year they decided to pull out, they can do that. And then at that time, we would immediately then have to pay up whatever that amount from here to there?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. The Deputy Commissioner Rutherford can address the more detailed questions as they pertain to the PA from a non-financial perspective, but from a purely financial perspective.
You got some competition outside the room here. From a little louder, please. We'd appreciate it.
From a purely financial perspective, there is a specified period of time in the PA during which the state needs to make the payment upon the triggering of the reimbursement obligation. During that period of time, the applicable interest rate, as we pointed out in our slides, is 7.1%. And beyond that time period, it increases above that by several percentage points.
And a follow-up?
Yeah.
So what would happen then? Let's say they pulled out. We didn't have the money. And that's a surprise, I'm sure. And we had to go and try to borrow the money. Wouldn't that make it much more difficult at the time, because then it would bring in why you were having to do it and why you don't have the money and more than just about the project itself?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, that's a very good observation. And in fact, in our slides, we analyzed this as a potential significant risk to the state as a result of keeping TransCanada in the project. Because if circumstances arise such that TransCanada has to be reimbursed because the project is not advancing for whatever reason. And at that point, let's say that this happens late in the development stage of the project, or even worse, during the construction period of the project. At that point in time, everybody in the lending community will know that there's a problem with the project, and there, which has caused the reimbursement obligation to be triggered, which means that now it will be well known that the state would not be expected to be receiving the revenues that would have otherwise been expected to come from this project anytime soon, if this is a serious problem, right? So, yes, the state could then be forced, especially if this is a large funding obligation, large reimbursement obligation, the state would be forced potentially to borrow and to borrow in adverse credit conditions when your lenders are going to know that you're not going to have a project and therefore not going to have the revenues associated with that project. This is indeed a risk. It is from our perspective, beneficial to the state if the state were to fund the midstream project cost directly before it's known that there's potentially a problem. If you incur the debt on your own credit and you borrow in order to pay for the midstream project costs, you'll be borrowing at a time when the project is still advancing and still there's an expectation of success. Right? Because again, if you're funding indirectly through TransCanada, the state cannot escape the obligation to pay those costs in the event of a failure. You have to repay them. And you do not want to have to repay them when the failure is a known fact.
Mr. Cantor, do you have something on there?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Satter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You gentlemen and your agencies have analyzed the financial implications of the TransCanada buyout. Now, the governor may or may not make the policy decision to terminate TransCanada, and if and when he makes that decision, the legislature will be on the hook to pay for the buyout. And that raises the question of alternative financing schemes. We have to look past that decision. The governor has proposed going to Asian buyers as equity owners and so forth. My question is, could you describe the implications for the project finances if we turn to buyers who would be able to look at both sides of our ledger sheet, both as equity owners and as customers?
Representative Sather, through the chair, it's a very good question. And part of the issue is going to be, what are the natures of that agreement? As Representative Newman has alluded to, one of the important factors is the nature of the funding and its credit behind the buyer who's going to enter into the equity agreement, and also the distribution of risk under that contract. We have seen, and that can run the spectrum depending upon the financial arrangements and a number of different factors. So what we have tried to do in our presentation today is examine all the possible sources, and as we get forward and more moving towards the project, we will give a more in-depth analysis of both the positives of the arrangement and also the risks that would be assumed by the state. I think it would be purely conjecture if we commented on arrangements today, because so much of the project needs to be fully developed and structured over time.
And I understand, I'll take advantage of the, I understand that often in large LNG programs, projects, that the customers do take some equity. Is that typical?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it is indeed customary to see buyers of LNG take equity positions in LNG projects. Yes.
Thank you, Representative. We get Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So I'm hoping this special session goes as smoothly as possible. But there are a whole set of other experts who were lined up. You guys are obviously leaving today. If we end up in the situation where the legislative budget and audit experts end up disagreeing with things you've said, are you going to be available to respond either by phone or in person?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, yes, we are under contract to the Department of Revenue, and to the extent that you wish our expertise, either by phone or in person, we will be available to return.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the day when all of the experts agree and we don't have to deal with that part. But
we wouldn't be.
We're not there.
Representative Garrett, the chair, we wouldn't be experts if we all agreed.
Thank you.
You know how attorneys work?
You want to tell us?
With that, Representative Thompson, we're going to close up the meeting for today. Gentlemen, thank you for your information. It's been very helpful, and we will get their contact information. I've already asked the administration for that, so we can ask questions there. If you've got written questions, that would probably be better. That way we get a little bit more involvement from the rest of the committee members at the same time, along with your answers and good explanations on them. Representative Thompson, tomorrow's calendar.
Thank you, Chairman Newman. If you have those questions, get them to Representative Newman, and he will get those questions, and I hope, gentlemen, that you'll be able to respond expeditiously so that we can get those questions and answers out to the entire committee. That goes to everybody in the room also, any representatives or any staff that have questions. Please send those so we can get those answers for you. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. It was very informative, and I'm sure we'll have some questions for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Our next meeting will be tomorrow, Sunday, at 3 p.m. right here in room 519. And tomorrow we'll have a continuation of the analysis of House Bill 3001 on the appropriation for possible buyout of TransCanada. Tomorrow's presenters will be Department of Revenue, Marty Rutherford, and Black and Veatch Principal, Deepa Potavole. And then on Monday, we'll be going back to our normal meeting times of 1:30 p.m. through the rest of the week with additional presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And then, again, thank you to the members leaving your homes during special session to be here to take care of the people's business. We certainly appreciate that and your dedication to this issue. I know that you all were very hard at it, and you've all been asking for information, and I know that you're studying it. With that, 3 p.m., so we'll close today. Thank you. Thank you.